The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. Well, this is another COVID-19 novel coronavirus episode.
Yeah, it's March 23rd. Normally we like to change topics, but there's really nothing else I want to talk about.
Nor is there anything more important to talk about given the way things. So here we are in studio, appropriately socially distanced. I have sanitized the table, the microphones and everything, and taking this all very seriously, and I hope all of our listeners are as well. I mean, it is really important that everybody socially distances. And I'll tell you that because I'm looking at these charts and graphs from around the world and a couple of lessons pop out. One, obviously, if you don't do those sorts of things, it gets away on you very quickly in your society. And the converse is, as I'm looking at these charts and we're going to talk about it, if you do take measures and do collaborate as a society, you can bend the curve. Mm-hmm. You can bend the curve. And there's early signs that this is happening in a couple of key countries as well.
Well, and it's not easy, right? Like, no. I think all of us Albertans have lived through just 1 week now of this, and it feels probably like a month or something like that.
It's hard on kids.
It's hard on families.
It's only been a week since the schools closed. And I mean, I don't know, every day seems like 10 days in terms of trying to navigate through all of this. So
what we're going to talk about is an update on COVID-19 in the United States and Europe especially, since those are very large crude oil markets. In the United States, super consequential for us. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at what these changes mean for oil demand and U.S. refineries that Canada depends on, and then talk about implications for Canada oil supply, which are really changing real time here. Like, every week we've been meeting and the situation has changed. Now I think our concern is really primarily around oil demand in the U.S. and what it means for Canada, and we want to talk about that.
Yeah, we do. Let's start with the coronavirus itself, the root of all these issues. So it started off in China, we know that, back in January. Then it migrated, I guess it would be westward, if you take it that way around the globe, to Iran, then to Italy, where it just took off like wildfire in the northern parts of the country, and then spread to other countries like Switzerland and France and Germany, and then into the Nordic countries, and then popped over the ocean and proliferated here and basically all over the world. So we have these, I'll call them super continental clusters. We've got the Asian continental cluster that, as I said, started back in early, mid-January. They were able to seemingly arrest it. Countries like China and South Korea, then there was Taiwan and Singapore, Hong Kong within China, and have been able to at least arrest it and bring it under control. The European situation, when you look at the numbers, is dire, especially when you look at the cumulative cases. But actually, if you look at the new cases per day, which is what I'm looking at, new cases per day is important because you want to make sure that at a minimum, you're leveling it out. You know, when every day you are logging or recording more cases than the previous day, it means that your cumulative cases are growing exponentially.
Mm-hmm. The chance for it to keep growing is growing, right?
Exactly. And then the proliferation, and it just gets completely out of control. With social distancing, self-isolation or forced isolation, the first thing that happens is that the number of new cases per day starts to level out, flatten out. And then if you look at the Chinese data, at some point it starts to go down. And that's when you bend, in quotations, the cumulative curve. Right. The cumulative curves have not yet bent, but what I'm noticing by looking at the daily data in Europe is that at least it's encouraging that it appears countries, I'm looking, you know, specifically France, Germany, even Italy, there's a couple days that actually the next day, like the say March 21st, is less than March 20th or leveled out in some of these countries. So that tells me that the lag of self-isolation or lockdown to bending the overall curve trajectory has actually started to happen, and that we should pay heed to that here, because it takes at least a week given all the lags for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be done. And so the focus, I think, is going to shift from Europe to here, but we can look over our shoulders to Europe and say, look, over there, it's starting to make a difference.
Right. So these methods do work.
Yeah.
They have big impacts on the economy, but they do
Yeah,
work.
We'll come to that. They sure do. But at least, you know, the glimmer of hope is to say, okay, look, they were able to do it over there, similar democracies mm-hmm. to ours, and that it can be done. Now, I'm not suggesting here that the epidemic is under control, but at least you can see the impacts of these measures starting to show up very early in the data. And that, to me, is positive. And these days, any piece of positive news is good news. What is not so encouraging is what is happening south of the border in the United States. There, I think we know cities like New York, states like California are starting to record exponential, and there's no indication that the daily new cases are slowing down from day to day to day, which means that the growth is exponential.
Mm-hmm. I was looking and they have, as of the latest data, 16,400 new cases versus 2,000 a week ago. So that's quite the rate of increase.
Yeah. And I think, you know, every day that goes by, you're going to see that number grow, which means that the cumulative cases grow exponentially. And until such time as that there is the impacts of social distancing, but that's not universal across every state, across every city in the United States. We know that there's states like New York and California, Illinois and others that have mandated these sorts of things. There's more and more coming. But you really need a wholesale effort. And the United States is a big country. You know, in China, they were able to isolate it within the Hubei province, right? And it did spread to other provinces around China, but it was dominantly isolated in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They just locked the whole thing down. In the United States, we have not yet seen that, and it's starting to proliferate.
Yeah, it seems to be getting everywhere. And, you know, over the weekend, there was two new lockdowns, one in Illinois and one in Louisiana. And I expect more states are going to be making that. And that has big consequences for our business.
It does.
Because the oil demand from the U.S. is going to go down as more and more restrictions are put in on people.
Yeah. So if you look at the European data, by the time you institute a lockdown to by the time you see a response just in the daily new cases in terms of leveling out and hopefully actually reversing, that in the United States is at least a week and a half away. I don't, we'll see,
mm-hmm.
and depending on how effective the lockdowns in cities like New York and places like that are. I just want to say, though, that, you know, looking over our shoulder to Europe and seeing the rollover is going to be important because it will prove to us that it can be done. We already talked about that. But so we're going to look over our shoulder and see the European situation hopefully improve as a consequence of their actions in the past. But south of the border, it's going to take a little bit longer. And as you say, this is hugely consequential to us and very consequential in terms of which regions have done the stay-at-home orders,
mm-hmm.
The self-isolation orders, and so on. So we've seen it in New York State. Importantly, we saw it in Illinois.
Right, and Illinois is a very critical market for Canadian crude oil. Before we get to that, I did want to share some of the outlooks for contraction in the U.S. economy, though, because of mm-hmm. all this. Some of these just came out on Friday, and just stunning numbers. Goldman Sachs saying about a 24% contraction in the GDP of the U.S. In this upcoming Q2. J.P. Morgan, 14%. They were saying that this would be the worst data since they started tracking quarterly data back to 1958. And in 1958, the worst quarter was a 10% quarterly contraction. We're talking like double that. So the U.S. economy has really not seen a contraction like
everything
that.
Everything is on pause. Everything is on in places where they have these stay-at-home orders. It's just like hitting the pause button.
Yeah. Like, have you used your credit card in the last week?
No,
this
I haven't.
Might be like one of the first weeks of my
well, for groceries,
a long time.
I haven't hit it, yeah.
Oh, you got some groceries. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the implications then. We talked about oil demand being a bigger and bigger issue last week and that the consensus view had gone from 2 million barrel a day drop in Q2 to maybe 5 million barrels a day. And some people were saying 10. Well, now, a week later, 10 seems to be the consensus view, which would be about 10% of global oil demand going away in Q2 on average.
So instead of 101 million barrels a day, when we were sitting here a couple months ago as the projection, we're looking at 90 million barrels a day. I think potentially momentarily it's going to be less than that given what's going on in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is what? It's 20 million barrels. It's one-fifth of world consumption.
Yeah, and you stop, for example, 8 million barrels a day is used in light-duty vehicles in the United States, and we're not moving around.
I even went on some webcams. You look at the freeways, they're just
empty. Yeah. And I think actually 10 million barrels a day was the out there forecast from last week, and now there's outlooks as much as 15 million barrels a day globally, and maybe as much as 6 or 7 million barrels a day lost in the U.S. They're a 20 million barrel a day market. So if those forecasts are right, and for sure there's lots of uncertainty right now, but that would be the equivalent of losing 1/3 of all the demand in the U.S. for the whole of Q2. And most estimates show, April, which is not going to look like a great month, is actually going to be worse. So big implications for Canada, because, of course, we only have pipelines that go to the United States. So we are highly dependent on demand from the U.S.
Yeah, this is where the dependency on one customer, and we used to say broadly, dependency on the United States was a big problem, concentration risk. This is why the argument was there, still is there, more than ever, that we need to diversify our markets by getting access to Tidewater. Okay, let's just put that aside because we know that. The real issue, though, is that the concentration risk is even more concentrated than we think. It's not just thinking about the United States as a whole, but when you lose Illinois, when everybody in Chicago stays at home, then all of a sudden you have a precipitous drop in gasoline consumption. We know jet fuel has already collapsed.
Yep.
And so that has massive ripple effects because of the refiners in the region, in Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, they have to turn down, right?
Yeah.
They got to turn down the operations. How does that work?
Well, so first of all, so for background, the Enbridge mainline, which we've talked about on the podcast before, is a very big line. It moves about 70% of all the crude oil that's exported from Western Canada. And a big consumer is the three big refineries in the Chicago, Illinois area. So there's BP Whiting, ExxonMobil Joliet, and Citgo Lamont. Altogether, those refineries take about 750,000 barrels a day of crude, Canadian crude.
Some of these are like 80% of their oil comes from Canada.
Yeah. So these refineries are super consequential. They are potentially being impacted by this turndown in a couple of ways. One is there will be less demand for refined products in the area and they may have to turn down. The other is there may actually be issues with COVID within the refineries, which may cause operational issues.
Yeah.
And so it's also a concern because the Enbridge mainline moves like 2.7 million barrels a day, and that goes to Ontario as well. And we just learned today that the Ontario government's putting even more strict lockdown procedures in. So only, essential services are allowed kind of out of their homes. Mm-hmm. So Ontario is another big market. That takes about 500,000 barrels a day of Western Canadian crude oil into Ontario. And I think those refineries may also be forced to run less throughput if they don't have the demand for their products. And that includes two Imperial refineries, a Shell and a Suncor refinery.
Yeah. I mean, you're saying if. I mean, it's not if anymore. It's happening in real time. And I think that this is the news of the week. Like, it's only Monday, but this is going to become the increasing issue of the week. So let's just recap here. 10 days ago, we were talking about the impacts on employment and the service sector and protecting jobs. Of course, that's still a huge issue more than ever. Then the narrative shifted to ensuring that we can keep our oil and gas industry solvent. What were the cash flow break-even prices and so on and so forth in the face of the price war and all that kind of stuff. Now, if that wasn't enough, we are now facing this issue of complete system backup. In other words, you have no place to put refined products like gasoline, diesel, jet fuel. You don't need it because everybody's staying at home and nobody's flying. So then the refineries turn down. If the refineries turn down, then it ripples all the way up pipelines like the Enbridge main line. Right. And then basically goes right back to the oil fields, and the oil fields have to shut in.
Yeah. Like, there's literally logistical constraints now. We're not talking about economics as much as there's going to be physical constraints. And just to put it in perspective, refined product inventories in the U.S. are at relatively high levels compared to what they typically are for this time of year. So there's some ability for the refineries to keep running and putting that into storage, but there's not really that much space relative to even normal times.
So you're talking about those big white tanks that you see sometimes if you drive by these things. They get filled up with refined products like jet fuel and diesel and what have you. But they're not at the tank tops yet.
They're not far off. They're much higher than they typically are.
Right.
And then the other issue is 2.7 million barrels a day goes down the mainline and goes to inland refineries. inland refineries typically do not have a lot of crude oil storage. So in a case where a refinery may turn down, it may still be able to accept crude oil for a while. But if you're just connected to a pipe that delivers every day to you, you're not really incented to create a bunch of tanks. If you're on the Gulf Coast and you're taking these very large crude carriers and they're coming in every
week,
you will have a lot of storage and ability to keep taking crude, even if your refinery maybe isn't running as much. But these inland refiners do not have much because there's a lot of pipeline connection, not only for the crude coming in, but some of the refined products going out. And so if they turn down their capacity, I'm not saying they're going to shut down altogether, but let's say if it's 30% that the U.S. declines in terms of its demand, you could see refineries turning down maybe 30%. And then that crude oil just can't keep flowing through the pipeline. There's just nowhere for it to go.
No. So, you know, we have a situation here that is emerging.
There's a couple things. If those refineries turn down, maybe the crude could continue on to the Gulf Coast. But the problem is, we have 2.7 million barrels a day or so coming into the Midwest region and only about a million leaving. So, and that's already mostly being used. So there's not much room for crude to go south. That said, those guys on the Gulf Coast are also suffering from lower demand and they don't need more crude oil right now either. So really it will back up into Canada. And I just did a quick calculation because the other problem we have, which we've talked about before, is in Alberta. We have very full storage tanks as well because of the fact that we've had a lot of supply and then we had that Keystone outage, which caused our tanks to fill up. So we only have about 5 million barrels by my count, and that was kind of end of February data. I don't have March data to absorb the situation. If refiners say, I don't need as much crude, the pipelines start moving less crude, and the producers don't change their production, and they, you know, that storage in Alberta doesn't have much capacity to absorb that if we don't see a turn down in the upstream side. So, I mean, the takeaway is when oil demand collapses, the oil needs to stop flowing. There's just going to be logistical constraints here to keep producing.
Yeah. I think, you know, the issue here is that North America is a very complicated grid of petroleum products from source, the wells, the oil fields, all the way to consumption, whether it's in jets, ships, cars, you name it. And then there's the whole petrochemical side of it, which is 60% of oil product, you know, plastics, et cetera. So these systems are extremely fine-tuned to operate on a day-to-day basis. And they can't really take these massive sudden shocks. It's just like the human body, a massive drop in blood pressure, right? I mean, you know, you create all sorts of complications to your different organs and so on. And the organs of the oil and gas energy industry, especially in this case, the oil side of it, are at risk of some system failure, market failure, certainly market failure, if this thing goes unchecked.
It's really like a game of dominoes, right? Yeah. One thing causes something else and you haven't even thought about all the unintended consequences. I've been doing a lot of thinking about all these domino effects, right? Like, great example, if the refineries turn down, first of all, that's going to affect natural gas demand. We're going to start to see less industrial demand. They supply a lot of feedstock to the petrochemicals. So if they start turning down, could you start to see a slowdown in the petrochemical sector in the U.S., which will affect industrial demand and other, other markets?
I mean, it's a knock-on effect. We don't necessarily need to extend this to the doomsday scenarios yet, but there's no question that we need to be, you know, we from the federal, provincial governments to the industry, collectively thinking about how to manage this all the way from upstream, midstream, downstream. And the reason is because when you do permanent damage to a system, then when you want to ramp it all back up and bring it back, it doesn't necessarily come back right away. This is not like flicking a light switch and the electricity goes on and off, right? I mean, it takes time to turn down production. Sometimes the reservoirs, certainly in the SAGD operations in the oil sands, you turn it off, you stop steaming, you do permanent reservoir damage.
Yeah, and I mean, there's safety concerns. I think, you know, in sour wells and things like that, there's potential for damaging assets in the oil sands. But I think you could see that in some of the conventional plays as well. And so you don't want to do this abruptly. You want to plan for it and think through all of this. Like, what's the best way to do it? How can I mitigate the potential for a downside? And I would actually say we have to think more holistically. I know each company is going to think individually, but as a province, what is the best production to be cut? Because at the end of this, we want to have all of our productive capacity that we can.
We have to start triaging this holistically.
let's put it in perspective. Now, I did some math here and wide range of outcomes. I should think all the listeners will know this is not certain. Okay. But let's say that the demand for Canadian oil would drop 10%. And by the way, it's not just Illinois. I think that you're going to see demand drop in all markets that we serve. So whether it's going down the Keystone or Express or other pipelines, there's the potential for refiners to not need as much crude. That would mean we'd need about 200,000 barrels a day of heavy oil shut-ins and about 100,000 barrels a day of light for production. If it were 30%, which I think is possible based on some of the latest outlooks for how oil demand is going to drop in the U.S.
I think it's, I mean, on a momentary basis, momentary meaning anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks.
Yeah, like for the month of April
For the month of April, this is not an unrealistic number. In fact, it could be light.
Well, and okay, if you, then that number would be about 500,000 barrels a day of heavy oil shut-ins and about 300,000 barrels a day of light that would need to be shut in. To put that in perspective, for the SAGD sites, if they were to make all of the heavy oil curtailments, that would be about a third of all SAGD production being cut in order to make that. Now, we have mining production as well that makes diluted bitumen, so maybe part of that would be cut. And on the light crude side, it could be the production from these mining upgrader sites, or it could be partly conventional production as well.
By the way, I mean, we're talking about the physical barrels. There is another knock-on effect, and that is on the fiscal side, the financial side. In other words, these pipelines, the producers or the refiners, they have take-or-pay contracts. In other words, if you don't ship on the pipeline, then you have to pay the pipeline company anyway. There is what's called counterparty risks. There's credit issues. If this goes on for any length of time, as I said, it has these knock-on effects that can lead to, you know, in the parlance of the economists or financial industry, market failures.
Well, what about the fact that in order to, this will be happening throughout the U.S., and I think it will happen, that Cushing will get full, which is a major hub
for Oklahoma.
Crude oil.
That's Oklahoma.
So it'll affect U.S. producers. I mean, there are outlooks out there that are saying that oil price in North America at WTI could get $15 or even $10, which would mean the price here in Alberta is pretty much zero, which of course will help with the shutdowns, but will create other financial issues for the companies, right?
No, so this is why we have to holistically look at the situation. The capitalist system has embedded in it a mechanism whereby companies can go bankrupt. There's winners and losers. However, the situation that's emerging is that everybody's going to be a loser if we're not careful. And that has all these knock-on effects, all the way not only from the ability to ramp up and restart, energy security issues, the ability to produce petrochemicals, to produce things like surgical masks, et cetera, right?
Yeah, and there's other knock-on effects too for Canada. I was thinking about it. If you did get into that range of needing about 500,000 barrels a day of heavy oil to be shut in, that would have an impact on our Canadian diluent market. So the natural gas producers do rely on the oil sands for selling their diluent to. And today, the price stays relatively high compared to crude oil prices in Western Canada because we need to import about 200 to 250,000 barrels a day of diluent from the U.S.
From Texas.
From Texas and other places in the U.S. And those actually come up via pipeline. But if you had that much of a shut-in, you don't need that imported diluent anymore.
Doesn't the diluent dominantly come from natural gas wells, or does it come from the oil wells?
It comes as a byproduct of natural gas.
Yeah.
So the natural gas producers have had very difficult time the last few years, but in general, you know, their prices have remained relatively high the last month for natural gas compared to what they lived through for the last couple of years. But they also rely on the diluent revenue, which has been hit by the lower oil price already. But if we have a situation where we don't need to import diluent from the U.S., then we may have a real local glut here of domestic diluent relative to what the oil sands guys need, and that could cause quite low prices for diluent as well.
This is not comforting talk, I gotta say, but the issue is real. The issue is real. The impact of the coronavirus, COVID-19, whatever you want to call it, starting to grow rampantly in the United States, leading to shut-ins and a stoppage of normal day-to-day activity, be it driving, flying, is leading to a precipitous drop in demand, which is going to now impact the energy systems with unforeseen consequences. So I think that this is an absolutely critical week. This week for sure, the next 2 weeks are really vital weeks. first of all, the good news is we're going to look over our shoulder, and I do believe we're going to see some improvement in the European side. But over the course of the next 2 weeks, I think we're going to see the pandemic numbers in the United States get worse. So I don't see the demand for the products falling off being a short-lived thing. Short-lived as in, oh, it's only a week or two. We can dump the stuff in storage. I think you're going to see this manifest itself over the next couple months until we start getting back up. So how we manage the situation over the course of the next couple weeks is going to be really consequential in determining how we come out of the valley at the other end, which we inevitably will. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of triaging what the issues are from an energy perspective, this has got to be one of the number one issues. And it affects us as Canadians, Western Canadians, and actually, because these U.S. refineries are dependent upon Canadian oil, it affects them as well. Mm-hmm.
There should be some motivation to collaborate on plans.
Yeah, this is not a cross-border issue. I mean, this is much bigger than just, okay, it's an Alberta oil field way up in the oil sands, right? This is a cross-border issue.
It's like an integrated supply chain, right?
Yeah,
and if one piece of it changes, it has effects all the way back in the system. Now, I just want to say, you know, it is highly uncertain. Right now, we've been watching U.S. refinery run rates. We have data up till March 13th, and they are still high at 86% utilization, the same level as the same time last year. U.S. weekly storage has not started building significantly. And so, you know, we need to watch these signposts to see, just like you're watching the coronavirus.
But the signposts, I mean, went by us a week ago. Like, this is March 13th data.
Yeah.
What are we? We're March 22? Today? 23? I don't know.
Like, we're March 23.
I'm losing
yes.
track of time.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. I mean, this is the perils of not having good, accurate data at your fingertips. We don't even know what it was, what it's been.
Yeah. I'll just say the U.S. has better data than Canada.
ours is not even transparent. I know that already anecdotally in talking to people in the industry that the refineries are turning down. It just hasn't shown up in the data because the data's lagged.
Well, in fact, we're actually seeing it not in the markets that affect us so greatly, but we're already seeing turndowns in some California refineries because they've been living with this for longer. And we've also seen some turndowns in Europe. So we've had refineries in the UK and Germany start to move down maybe 20% of their capacity. And we do remember, we've seen this story in China. In China, they cut about 11% of all their capacity throughout the whole country. So, you know, as you said, they weren't spread throughout the whole country with these impacts either.
Right.
So we do know that does happen. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The situation is highly uncertain. It does look like we need to prepare for this. You know, I used to work at IHS and we talked a lot about scenario analysis, and you have to think through these scenarios, think of your plan because when you get there, you don't want to be doing it on the fly. We have time right now.
No. And I purposely painted a couple of doom and gloom scenarios there because they are scenarios. We're not sitting here saying that's what's going to happen. But honestly, we don't know where this pandemic is going. And so to not consider some of these potential outcomes is unwise.
Yeah, like I think every company should be thinking within the company, well, how if you got to that situation where there was physically constraints and you couldn't move crude oil in the pipelines that you depend on, what would you do? How would you shut in your operations? How would you do it safely? How would you mitigate the risks of that? At a broader level, industry-wide level, I think we need to be thinking about how it would work, what would be the most efficient way, which assets make the most sense. And then when that day comes, if it does come, then we have a plan.
Yeah.
If it doesn't come, then that's a blessing and we don't need that plan, but we need to get that in place.
But the scenario that I think you and I are very confident in saying is that there are going to be turndowns in the key refineries that take Canadian crude. And therefore, that is going to back up. And the province's oil fields are going to have to start shutting in some of their production if they already haven't.
Well, and we will watch on the signposts that I'll be watching is those U.S. refinery run rates, weekly data, U.S. weekly storage data. Peter will continue to track all the coronavirus changes. And we look forward to updating you on our next podcast.
We hope everybody stays healthy and well during this very difficult time. And remember, please keep your distance from people at an absolute minimum. Just really be responsible about that because it does make a difference and we all need to work together.
Good. Well, thank you for joining this podcast. If you like this podcast, tell someone else about it and rate us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.